Good morning. You're listening to 88.7 WHCL-FM, Clinton, New York. I'm your host, Pete Bianco, and this show is titled The Ringer. This morning on the telephone with me, I have Tamer Mahena. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Very recently, I had no idea about the story that involves your brother, and I did see that it made some headlines the other day because his trial has come to an end. But can you give us a history of your brother Tarek Mahena's trial and what has been involved from starting from accusations, I guess?
Certainly. Well, my brother Tarek and I, we were both born and raised here in the United States as Muslim Americans, and I mean, we grew up pretty run-of-the-mill childhood, as you know, like the same as any other American kids. You know, same interests, comic books, music, things like that. And around the time when my brother graduated from high school and was preparing to enter college, his thoughts on faith began to mature a bit, and he began to take his religion a bit more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Tarek had always been somebody who, you know, any of his interests, he'd always been one to, like, you know, to take them quite seriously. For example, when he was into music, he was an expert on any of the musicians that he was a big fan of. It was his way to become, he was almost scholarly in all of his interests.
Mm-hmm.
And it was no different when he turned to Islam as his primary interest. And so, basically, I mean, this was around year 2000 or so that this was taking place, and it was kind of a rough time to be for a Muslim here in America to be getting in touch with, like, you know, his Muslim identity with 9/11 around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, there was a lot of confusing events taking place, a lot of questions that not many people had answers for, and, you know, my brother being somebody who liked to know everything about, I mean, any of his interests, I mean, it only went doubly so when you're talking about, like, him realizing his religious identity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that led him kind of to really, like, dig into, like, a lot of the primary texts of the religion, like, ancient texts, books that you'd need to really have, like, a specialized understanding of Arabic. And so he began translating a lot of these texts because he recognized that, you know, that it was a way that he could provide that as a gateway for, like, you know, Muslim converts and for non-Muslims to learn what Islam is really about, you know, in an era where, like, there's a lot of misinformation that's flying around because it's, you know, post 9/11.
Right. There's Islamophobia.
Oh, yeah, it's very prevalent, but, like, you know, my brother always believed that, you know, that, like one of the most noble things he could do as a Muslim, especially living here in America, is to call people to Islam in a way that's respectful and engaging,
mm-hmm.
And he dedicated a lot of his time to really specializing in doing that. Basically, what happened was, beginning in around 2004, 2005, the FBI started approaching him because, you know, again, I hate to keep saying it, but post 9/11, a lot of things changed, including, you know, the way that, you know, national security agencies began to view Muslim communities,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of, like, you know, they're, like, as a security threat.
Mm-hmm.
And part of this, you know, a very prominent element of this change in paradigm was the FBI beginning to really ramp up its use of informants in the Muslim community. You know, it's reached epidemic proportions. It's really absurd, you know, and there's a lot of fear and paranoia among Muslims, you know, because they're afraid to be associated with extremist elements of Islam because, you know, here in the United States, I think for many Americans, it's tough to differentiate between, you know, like, a Muslim who holds extremist beliefs and one who doesn't, because just simply because there's so little that's known about Islam.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of Muslim Muslims feeling like they can't find, you know, security in their American Muslim communities, they roll over when the FBI comes and says, look, we want you to be an informant in our community. And, you know, it sounds like something out of like a, you know, like a Pulp Fiction comic or something, but this is actually, this happens, and it's very frequent. And the reason why this happens a lot, the reason why this has, you know, become rampant is because, I mean, post 9/11, the FBI, you know, their image took a big hit on 9/11 because a lot of Americans were questioning, how could you let this happen? You know, there was all these signs that you evidently ignored.
Right.
You know, like, and so the FBI felt pressured to repair its image. And so what happens is you have all these homegrown terror cases now where individuals are essentially entrapped by informants in their communities, and the FBI is always there to, you know, to nab them and arrest them and, you know, look heroic and stuff. And it really, you know, it's like a PR campaign practically for them. And my brother was extremely certain that when the FBI approached him seeking to recruit him as an informant, that it would be a similar type of situation where he would, where he felt he would be doing something immoral by entrapping fellow Muslims. He felt Tariq was much more passionate about the idea of providing the proper leadership to Muslims who may be going possibly leaning towards these extremist views. He felt that rather than arresting and incarcerating and prosecuting such individuals, all they need is a bit of leadership so that they, that their faith can acquire those mature elements that can help them avoid that and be, you know, an asset to their society here in the United States. And so he refused to become an informant, and for the next 4 years, from 2004 until 2008, the FBI repeatedly approached him and went to great lengths to put increasing pressure on him to get him to agree to become an informant for them. Because you see, like, Tariq, you know, he has this uniquely, like, strong character, and part of that is a strong belief in giving back to his community, community service. And so even though my brother, you know, like, graduated from pharmacy school with a doctorate in pharmacy, he spent most of his time at the Worcester Islamic Center, which has like an academy for youth, and he would teach like, you know, the younger generation of kids science, math, religion, and history, because he felt that, you know, that our community had given us so much growing up, and he felt that it was so important to give back to our community.
Did they targeted him because he was so trusted in the community?
Well, that's exactly what I was getting at right there, is that because of all the time he spent there, and not just at the Worcester, Massachusetts Islamic Center, but many of the other major centers around here, he acquired a reputation. He became well-known and well-respected and well-trusted. And this made him like the ideal candidate to be an informant. Because, again, you know, like, when you're entrapping people, it requires gaining their trust. It requires, you know, not triggering suspicion. And there was nobody better for that than my brother, because people knew that he was just a very straightforward person. He's a very, very straightforward and principled person, and there would be no fear of suspicion, you know, of entrapment. And my brother continued to refuse, and this was extremely, extremely frustrating to the FBI. And in 2008, you know, like, that's when things kind of escalated.
That's 3 years after they initially made contact.
Right. 3 or 4 years after that. And, you know, I mean, they would, you know, over those 3 or 4 years, they repeatedly approached him. They call these sit-downs interviews, but in reality, they're more like interrogations, because, you know, the FBI is not, they're not particularly cordial in how they conduct these things. You know, it's, you know, they'll knock on your door, you open your door, and they're like, hi, you know, we'd like to speak to you, we're with the FBI, and, you know, if you know what's good for you, you'll say, oh, well, I'm sorry, I'd rather have a lawyer when I speak to you, because, you know, they're federal agents, so if you say something that maybe can be in some way, like, framed as being a false statement to them, mm-hmm. then that's a felony right there, and mm-hmm. so it's very important when you're speaking with them, particularly when it's part of, like, an investigation, mm-hmm. that you have proper representation. And when you say that, they'll respond to you by saying, oh, well, are you sure you want to take it that far? Oh, you really want to make a big issue of this? It's like, no, we're just exercising our rights.
Now, how is that different from when you speak to a police officer, they have to tell you that you have the right to remain silent? The same is not true with federal agents, then, I assume.
Well, I mean, with federal agents, they're federal, you know, so, I mean, you're talking like, I'm not entirely certain what state law says about, you know, what the loopholes are with, like, giving false statements or giving somewhat, like, ambiguous statements to state police officers. But, I mean, with the FBI, it's, you know, if you go, like, for example, if you take a look at some of the reports published by Mother Jones mm-hmm. on their website, you know, they've published at length about how it's, you know, it's part of their, like, bread and butter, part of the FBI's bread and butter to use false testimony charges to arrest people, to hold on to them, or to put pressure on them to essentially comply with their demands.
I see.
You know, these false testimony charges, it's so easy for them to land these things. So, you know, they had to sit down with my brother at one point, and they asked him about the whereabouts of a certain individual. And my brother, again, not wanting to be party to bringing harm to somebody that he felt was a good person and a friend who had done nothing wrong, he answered vaguely.
Mm-hmm.
And so they used this. This conversation took place, I think, in 2006. Or, excuse me, no, 2007. And, you know, like, over the following year, now, the first time my brother was arrested, he was arrested twice. You see, he was arrested in October 2008, and he was arrested again in October 2009. So he had this conversation in 2007, and over the next couple of months through 2008, the FBI basically tried to use this as leverage over him, telling him, look, you know, like, you made a false statement to us, and, you know, like, we can either do this the easy way, you collaborating with us, or the hard way, us taking you to, like, a.k.a. the court way, mm-hmm. like, us taking you to court and charging you with making a false statement to us, and that's a very serious charge, like, you're not going to be able to work as a pharmacist because you're going to have a felony on your record. And so from March 2008 until about August 2008, it was extremely tense in my family's household. Because my parents were aware that Tariq had been approached multiple times by the FBI. They were extremely worried about him. But my brother would always tell them, it's okay, don't worry, because I'm not doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have freedom of speech in this country, and it's okay for me to be critical of the government and of its foreign policies, and it's okay for me to talk about my religion without needing to worry about it. I'm not doing anything wrong. And so for that couple of months, from March to August 2008, again, very tense in my household, the FBI was really trying hard to put pressure on him to collaborate. It was clear how frustrated they were. They even put him on a no-fly list. And this was a big deal because my brother had graduated in that year, and he had a great job lined up in Saudi Arabia, amazing package. He'd already sent all of his belongings, you know, He'd shipped all of his belongings overseas by August, and he was prepared to go and take up a job developing a diabetes protocol in the largest and most modern hospital in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, again, being concerned about this whole no-fly list, he basically, you know, he went through every effort to try to determine whether he was still on this no-fly list once the FBI's pressure had died down. everything looked like a green light. I dropped him and my parents off in October 2008 at the airport for him to take off. You know, my parents, they were so worried about him that they were going to take a connector flight from New York, or from Boston to New York, to see him off to Riyadh. And 50 minutes after I dropped him off, I get a call from my family saying that he's been arrested, and that the FBI agents, despite the bureau in Boston having told my brother that there was no problem, that he was able to travel, they were waiting for him at the plane. Like, they're standing, you know, at the entrance to the aircraft itself. You see, because it's psychological to them. They were very bitter that he'd refused to collaborate as an informant, because nobody refuses to collaborate as an informant when the FBI tells them they'll make their life a living hell. And yet here's this individual, Tariq Mahana, who could care less about, like, the threats that they're making to him. And he's simply refusing to be an informant, and it was driving them mad. And so, you know, like, you see these tactics which are intended to maximize psychological harm to the person as leverage for them to get the person to crack. And I can tell you, for my parents sitting there, seeing my brother get arrested in front of, you know, the general public, it was extremely traumatic for us. Extremely traumatic. They arrested him. They charged him with a false testimony to an FBI agent. 4 months later, my brother was out on bail. And, you know, the same judge who had let out...
What was that bail?
Just for context, the same judge who let him out on bail had let somebody who was charged with running a child pornography ring out on bail for $50,000. My brother's bail was $1.25 million for a false testimony. For a false statement to an FBI agent.
That's outrageous.
It's absurd. That's totally well beyond the ballpark of what such a charge should carry. Again, it's meant as something to intimidate the individual in order to get them to crack. So my brother was let out on bail. He got out on bail. He returned home in 2009, January 2009, and, you know, he was on, like, you know, a monitored curfew for the following 8 months. He started working as a pharmacist. He continued, you know, contributing to the community at the Worcester Islamic Center and forging strong bonds there. Come October 2009, about 8 months later, one morning, my family is preparing to make the morning prayer, because, you know, we as Muslims, we pray five times a day. There's five obligatory prayers upon us. One of them is at sunrise. So my family was getting up to prepare for the sunrise prayer. Next thing we know, we hear a very loud knock on the door. This is at about 4 a.m. or so, 4 or 4:30 a.m. Loud knock. My father was startled. He goes downstairs, opens the door. And there's a bunch of FBI agents outside waving an arrest warrant. What's interesting, though, about how that came to be was that, you know, this arrest warrant was not issued in the standard way that arrest warrants are issued. They had to petition the magistrate, the court magistrate, with what we call a complaint, indicating that my brother was not only fear that my brother was a flight risk, which was what they had said back in 2008 when he was arrested. No, now they also fear that he was a danger to his community. Interestingly enough, despite the fact that there was no new evidence collected between 08 and 09. You see, so my brother was arrested in 2008, charged with a false testimony to an FBI agent charge. And then in 2009, despite The FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, both of them acknowledged at his arraignment in 2009 that there had been nothing new collected between 08 and 09. And yet all of a sudden now, he's a threat to the community. And the day that he was arrested in 2009, all over the news. All you hear about is, oh, this individual, Tariq Mahana, was plotting to acquire firearms to go shoot up shopping malls. Like,
you don't...
an outlandish story that has no basis in reality or fact, and this was proven during the trial.
Mm-hmm. And there's no a knowledge of who started that rumor, which news outlet or
Well, the thing is, the rumor was started... You see, my brother, during his trial, like, the irony of this... Bear in mind that my brother was arrested in 2009,
mm-hmm.
and his trial began just this past October, 2011.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was in solitary confinement for 2 years without ever being, you know, without ever having been convicted of anything.
That's unbelievable.
Solitary confinement for 2 entire years, like, you can't imagine how difficult it made that to deal, to interact with his defense attorneys. And that became a big issue because let me tell you, the government pulled some wild shenanigans when it came to the discovery process. You know, like the pre-trial process of government revealing its evidence.
I've just been through a trial myself, so yes, I'm familiar.
Like, they released such a tremendous volume of discovery that without specifying, like, what they were charging my brother with, that it was really absurd. Imagine, for the longest time with my brother in solitary confinement, we didn't even have, my family and his own attorneys did not even have any idea what he was being charged with. They didn't know what he was being charged with. All they were faced with was a tremendous amount of evidence, or of discovery. You can't even dignify it with the term evidence. You know, like,
mm-hmm.
thousands and thousands of pages of what? Chat logs. Of, like, instant message chat logs. Of emails. Nothing indicative that this individual did anything. Just a lot of speech. A lot of speech. And, you know, it was like pulling teeth to get the government to specify, oh, we're charging him with this and this and this. And next thing you know, my brother, you know, a superseding indictment is filed, which charges my brother with 7 charges. All of a sudden, we're going from this false testimony to an FBI agent back in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Without any new evidence, all of a sudden now we're dealing with 7 charges. We're dealing with conspiracy to provide material support to terrorists, conspiracy to kill in a foreign country, attempt to provide material support to a foreign designated terrorist organization, and 3 false testimony to a federal agent charges.
Mm.
How do you go from this one charge to these 7 charges in the span of a year when the government admits that nothing new happened in that year?
Mm-hmm.
It was very bizarre to us, and it was just one of many bizarre positions that the government took. For example, the government took issue with a trip that my brother took in 2004 to go to Yemen. My brother went there because Yemen is renowned as a place to study that kind of pure Arabic that we were referring to earlier, that type of Arabic that you need to master in order to be able to study a lot of these older core scriptures of Islamic jurisprudence. You know, jurisprudence, that's like, you know, that's the study of, like, the legal scripture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that my brother was very, very passionate about and very committed to, was what does, like, you know, the legal scripture, the Quran, which is our holy text, our equivalent of the Bible or the Torah, and the hadith, which are like our psalms. Like, what do those say about different aspects of how we practice our religion? Anything from how we deal with our families, to how we pray, to what does it say about jihad? Because, you know, jihad, even though it's a buzzword in American society, jihad is an obligatory function in Islam, but it does not mean anything close to what, you know, like, the American public is accustomed to it meaning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, jihad has many different meanings, and one of them is certainly to use force in self-defense, but in self-defense, not as an aggressor. Mm-hmm. You see, like in Islam, there's very strict rules about how force is used in military situations, in conflict zones. There's very strict and detailed rules about it, and you know, anybody who's familiar with those rules will tell you that it is nothing at all that can be conflated with terrorism. But, you know, here in the prevailing climate that we live in the United States today, jihad is conflated with terrorism. And a lot of the materials my brother translated, a lot of these ancient texts that he would painstakingly, you know, seek out and acquire, like, you know, whenever we went to Egypt for vacation every year because we're Egyptian, my brother would seek out these hole-in-the-wall bookstores and find, like, these rare texts that have never been translated into English, and he would translate these and put these up on his blog. And, again, his translation's dealing with a broad variety of topics. One of those topics was jihad. And it's kind of an inescapable topic, again, in a post-9/11 environment, being a Muslim in the United States. You know, you can't escape curiosity about it, questions about it, because I think for a lot of Americans, when they think of Islam, jihad is one of the first things that pops into their mind. And, you know, it's unfortunate that many people don't have a clear understanding of what Islam says about that. And it's even more troubling that many Americans do not have an understanding of the basic tenets of Islam overall. Mm-hmm. And my brother tried to translate these texts to give people an understanding of that, and the government charged him with providing material support or conspiring to provide material support to Al-Qaeda because he was expressing views that were critical of U.S. foreign policy and at times admired, you know, organizations that the U.S. has designated as terrorist organizations, and for translating, you know, materials that discuss jihad, mm-hmm, and making those available on his blog. So, and one of those materials was the 39 Ways Serve and Participate in Jihad. It's an ancient text that was released recently, which details different ways to participate in nonviolent jihad.
Hmm. So
I kind of went on for a bit there.
Not a problem. The other thing that this, as this is a terrible injustice to your brother, not only is it that, but it's also a threat to everyone else because of the precedent that this case would be setting by charging someone with all of these charges, and it's not based on any actions but only on someone's personal beliefs and their thoughts. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true. Let me give you a few examples of exactly how that's come to light during the trial. For example, the government claimed that my brother was, you know, somebody who was an active and avid participant on extremist forums, you know, online forums, where Muslims with violent extremist ideologies would exchange views and exchange, you know, propaganda materials and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Now, one such forum that they made a big deal about was this forum called Tibian Publications. And they went on and on about how, you know, Tariq translated this text and posted it on this forum, and how this text, you know, like, says the word jihad here and here and here and here and here. And, you know, they just tried to, like, say the name Osama bin Laden as many times as possible to frighten the jury, and to say Al-Qaeda, and to say 9/11, and to show pictures, like, pictures that had nothing to do with my brother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pictures of, for example, of Al-Qaeda leaders, like Zarqawi and Ayman al-Zawahiri. And
now,
they would spend...
Could his attorney object to that and say that's outside of the scope of the trial?
Absolutely. Repeatedly. And he became very... he was quite, impassioned at a certain point as he was doing so, because it became absurd how the prosecution's entire case was built upon showing photographs of 9/11, of talking about these Al-Qaeda leaders in Iraq and elsewhere, people who had nothing to do with Tariq, but you see who create this, who stimulate...
Well, I think we lost Tamara. Give him a call back. And in the meantime, please stay tuned in. Thank you. Okay, we made it back on the air.
All right, excellent.
So I guess, as you said, that may have been too much excitement for one conversation and overloaded our soundboard here. But where you left off was you were telling us about how there's all this information that was being introduced to the jury that really didn't relate to your brother's case.
There was a lot of that going on. It was shocking to see that. Firstly, there was a tremendous amount of prejudicial evidence that for some reason the judge allowed the prosecution to present. Non-substantive prejudicial evidence, such as spending hours of time discussing leaders of Al-Qaeda that no connection between them and my brother was ever made. But you see, talking about, for example, this individual beheaded an American or this or that, gruesome things that shaped the opinions and the opinions that the jurors have of my brother. Without ever linking those individuals to my brother, because there is no link.
Right.
There is no link. And this went on for hours at a time. There were entire days where my brother's name was not even mentioned. That's how ridiculous this got.
So this his attorney, his objections were overruled in these scenarios?
Oh, yes. They were overruled because the Judge O'Toole... ruled that it was relevant to the case. Keeping in mind that the same judge hears something, for example, that the defense brought up, which he ruled as being irrelevant. I think it was in 2007 or so, the NYPD's counterterrorism unit sent an undercover provocateur over state boundaries to Boston to meet with my brother in order to try to recruit him for a violent event, for a terrorist attack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was the FBI's, the Boston FBI's investigation. But see, by this point, it was, they weren't having much luck. And with all these homegrown terror prosecutions popping up, I mean, it's almost like a competition to see who can get more notches on their belt.
Mm-hmm.
Between, these different, governmental agencies, between the FBI, between the heavily funded and well-resourced NYPD counterterrorism unit. And so it was almost like they were like, oh, well, let's show these FBI guys how it's done. Let's nab this guy that they haven't had much luck with. So they send this undercover provocateur over state boundaries, thinking that my brother will just go along with, this plot that this individual concocted. And they were pretty shocked when my brother, lo and behold, turned down this offer to participate in a terrorist event.
Mm-hmm.
Flat out rejected it, which, any sane person would do.
Mm-hmm.
And this clearly made a big problem for the NYPD, because the head of the counterterrorism unit personally traveled to Boston to explain to the FBI office there why they had interfered with the FBI's investigation. The FBI were livid. All of this was revealed to us by journalists who had independent contacts in the NYPD. Mm. And this all came out pre-trial. And you see, this is what we call exculpatory evidence. This is evidence that would help the defendant.
Right.
And
it puts it into context.
Right. It puts into context the fact that my brother wasn't waiting around for like some opportunity to engage in a terrorist event. Here's somebody who flat out, who directly like sought to recruit him for this, an undercover provocateur, and my brother rejected it. And naturally, this was extremely concerning to the NYPD because they knew it would be extremely concerning to the FBI because, again, it constitutes exculpatory evidence that Tariq Mehenna was not, you know, some, you know, extremist who was just looking for any opportunity to harm people. And the judge ruled that this was irrelevant.
I have another question for you. What about the fact that your brother spent 700 days in jail before coming to the trial? What about the right to a speedy trial? What did his defense have to say about that?
There is no right to a speedy trial, and imagine how challenging it is for his defense to meet with him in order to prepare a defense against the tremendous volume of discovery provided by the government when he's in isolated confinement in a prison that's an hour and a half away from their office. Mm. You know, I can tell you how difficult it made things because I was the interface between them oftentimes. Mm-hmm. You know, it was oftentimes when my brother calls my family, I would have to call the defense attorneys and say, hey, here's a message from Tariq. He's wondering when he's going to get to see you guys. You know, and it's really unfortunate, and the conditions that he's in, I can't stress how big of a deal it is to be locked in isolated confinement when you have a case that's this complex, where there's this much evidence that needs to be gone over in order to be prepared entering this case, and yet to be in isolated confinement and unable to meet freely with your attorneys. It's like, put yourself in those shoes. How would you feel when your life is on the line? You're facing life in prison, and you're sitting there helpless. Because, trust me, you're helpless when you're sitting in isolated confinement. You're absolutely helpless. Mm-hmm. You rely on everybody to do everything for you, because you have no autonomy. You have no ability to do things in the outside world for yourself. You know, it's crazy, and it gets even crazier, Pete. You know, given the fact that my brother wrote a great deal. You know, my brother was a very scholarly individual, and again, like I mentioned earlier, he had a blog where he posted a great deal of translated material that he had personally translated to make available to non-Muslims and the Muslim converts on a variety of topics. And many of those topics include what are the Islamic legal rulings on the use of violence, what does it say about, like, you know, the, you know, like, your loyalty to, like, you know, the laws of a non-Muslim country that you're living in as a Muslim. Mm-hmm. You know, there's, like, this pact called Aman, which states that as long as you're a Muslim who lives in a non-Muslim country, as long as you're allowed to practice your religion in that country unrestricted, then you have to follow the laws of that country, even though it's not a Muslim country. Mm-hmm. You see, and this is something my brother believed very strongly in, and he wrote about it a great deal. You know, like, he wrote about it, and there were individuals who would challenge the things that he wrote. These are individuals who have that very same extremist mentality that the government accuses him of having. And these individuals would post comments on his blog attacking him for saying, the viewpoints that he would espouse, the moderate viewpoints he would espouse. And my brother would engage them head on and refute their beliefs. Mm-hmm. But evidently, none of this was important to the prosecution. None of this mattered. They didn't bring up his blog a single time, despite the fact that it was chock full of things that he had written, lengthy statements expressing his views very clearly, and showing that those views were diametrically opposed to the picture that the prosecution was trying to paint of him. It was very selective how they would cherry-pick the things that he wrote in order to show him to be a kind of a monster, mm-hmm. a very scary individual in front of the jury. And, you know, I mean, they say that it's a that you get judged by a jury of your peers. Now, the problem being Muslim in America, Pete, is that in order for them to be your peers, they need to understand your religion. Mm-hmm. You know, when your only understanding of Islam is, you know, like jihad and, you know, terrorism and what you hear on the mainstream news, what you hear on Fox News, like, how does that qualify an individual as, you know, as a peer to somebody like my brother who takes his religion very seriously?
And so there was no one on the jury was Muslim?
No, of course not. Not even anybody Arabic speaking. You know, I don't want to paint the wrong image of Tariq here, because, like, bear in mind, Tariq, like, yeah, he was very into his religion, but, like, you know, Tariq also, like, I mean, he was a normal young adult in his 20s. Mm-hmm. You know, we like to go watch Jet Li movies. We like to go grab sushi. We like to, you know, like, I mean, like, it's not like religion was his one and only focus. In fact, even, like, you know, one of his strong beliefs was that, you know, like, if you're going to be a religious Muslim, then it's an obligation on you to be a social person and to really kind of, like, to mingle with people so that you can expose them, you know, to your faith. Mm-hmm. And hopefully, you know, like, in a way that's attractive to them. You know, so it's like, you know, my brother wasn't like some, you know, like some ostracized individual who, like, you know, like, holed up in his room and, like, you know, and didn't come out of it, didn't socialize. No, he was a very social person. He was well known. He had friends from both Muslim and non-Muslim communities. He was he was very much a role model figure for many people. And this is why we have so many people who are supporting him, and who have shown up every single day to all of the hearings. Every day we get at least 40 people. Imagine that. Every day for 34 or 35 days of trial testimony, we get about 30 to 40 supporters who show up to bear witness to his trial. Mm-hmm. Minimum 30 to 40 people. And, you know, a lot of people are watching what's going on with him. A lot of people were very shocked about the verdict. A lot of people were very shocked about the verdict because his defense team really did an outstanding job of providing evidence to the jury that Tariq's only interest was in learning about his religion, improving his faith as a Muslim, and sharing his faith with non-Muslims in a peaceful and respectful way. And they showed all of these writings that the prosecution neglected to reveal. They provided a lot of context, and they brought outstanding expert witnesses, including one gentleman, Dr. Mark Sageman, who is arguably, like, the leading international expert on terrorism. He literally wrote the army manuals on this.
Wow.
Yes, and he came to testify that you know, I mean, all of his research is essentially based on, you know, whenever there's like a terrorist event that's reported in the media in the Western world, he basically flies out there and conducts a thorough investigation on the ground, mm-hmm. in order to determine what the context is, like who was involved, like, you know, what their motivations were, how they knew each other, what their ideology was, what led them to that violent ideology. Mm-hmm. And he would study these, he would conduct a comparative analysis of that alongside individuals who did not gravitate towards violent extremism or who had, you know, like strong Islamic ideologies, but who did not, you know, turn to violence. And this enabled him to develop a theory about, you know, what kind of individuals would turn to violence and which, what kind would not. And we, the defense brought him out because, I mean, like, the prosecution was alleging that Tariq wanted to plot violent attacks at shopping malls here. That he went to Iraq, that he wanted to go to Yemen, not to seek schooling in Arabic, but rather to seek militant training. And Dr. Mark Sageman was one of our witnesses who was there to testify that this was, that Tariq was not the type of individual who shared any of Al Qaeda's views.
Was Tariq in the courtroom?
During? Of course, yeah.
Okay. I didn't know if he was, you know, present for the whole trial, and so he was able to witness all of the shenanigans that were happening.
He was able to witness all the shenanigans. He was able to witness also six of his closest friends since childhood, who unfortunately, unlike him, were not resilient when faced with FBI pressure, rolled over and agreed to testify against him. Mm-hmm. Now, bear in mind, these are the same exact individuals that had Tariq agreed to collaborate with FBI, Tariq would be helping them build cases against these individuals. So you see the irony here.
Yeah, they're just trying to build a case on anyone so that they can save their reputation.
So- oh, absolutely. And they all have, like... They all have incentives to cooperate. You see, either immigration issues. One of the individuals, his father had been prosecuted on immigration issues and deported. This individual had testified against his father in his father's trial 2 years ago. And now it's the same prosecutors who had prosecuted his father were prosecuting my brother. So you see, it's like he already had a dose of what they could do if he didn't collaborate with them. Right. He would end up like his dad, deported back to Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was, you could see the struggle, the internal struggle on his face of testifying against one of his best friends growing up and not wanting to suffer the same consequences his father suffered, consequences that he had helped his father suffer. But even worse than that, there were other, you know, the star witness of the prosecution, an individual by the name of Kareem Abu Zahra, a cooperating witness. You know, this individual was one of the people who traveled with Tariq to Yemen. But before reaching Yemen, this individual had turned back. You know, they took a connector flight to a certain country, and before proceeding to Yemen, this individual turned back. And then the FBI approached him after he'd returned, and, you know, within 2 months of approaching him, he'd signed an agreement to wear a wiretap in conversations with my brother. Hmm. Imagine that. Imagine if your best friend is wearing a wiretap and continues acting like he's your best friend, recording conversations with you. You know, I mean, like, there's things that we say in private conversations that, you know, that you can't build context for when you're sharing those conversations with people who are not meant to be party to them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's ways that we talk to, like, our closest friends. There's ways that we talk to, you know, significant others that, you know, that you can't build the context for that with a jury that, you know, that comes from a different worldview.
Did they use any of those wiretaps during the trial?
Yeah, of course. They played, like, clip after clip after clip for 2 days. And, I mean, you could hear the individual, the cooperating witness, Kareem Abu Zahra, trying to get Tariq to say, like, certain things, like, you know, like, just talking about, like, you know, Yemen and, like, about how everybody there, like, carries weapons and stuff, and just trying to, in any way possible, to get Tariq to say something that could be twisted into, oh, like, you know, a violent purpose for going to Yemen. You know, one of the most interesting things about this Yemen trip, which, you know, which the government only began to focus on later during, you know, the first half of the trial. One of the interesting things is, you know, it was my brother and this individual, this cooperating witness, Karim Abu-Zahra, and a third individual, who, the three of them went to Yemen together. This Abu-Zahra character, he's the one who financed everything. My brother wasn't planning on going on this trip, but he basically told my brother, hey, if you want, you know, like, it would be great to have you along. We'll buy you a ticket. Return ticket, 2-week round-trip tickets. Just come with us. I'll pay for everything. You don't even have to pay me back. So my brother was like, sure. You know, I mean, like, my brother is a scholar, or somebody who aspires to, like, an Islamic scholar. And, hey, here's a free trip to Yemen, which has a unique reputation in the Islamic world as, like, the place to learn about exactly the type of Arabic that you need to translate these scholarly texts. So, of course, he's going to go. Mm-hmm. And he went. And now, here's the funny part. The prosecution says, oh, he went to Yemen in order to seek military training. Now, I mean, like, you'd hope that the government would have evidence for this. That they wouldn't just, you know, like, pull it out of their back pocket like that with no grounding. So, but the defense challenged that. The defense was like, is there any evidence that there were even any training camps there? Uh-huh. And the prosecutors, who clearly didn't do their homework, they went back, they took a look, and they came back and they said, no, but you went there intending to find training camps. That's enough. You went there intending to find them.
That's outrageous. I think that they would could object to that as hearsay. Where, you know, where is the primary source of evidence that that's the case?
Well, we brought an individual. His name was an expert witness by the name of Gregory Johnson, a Fulbright fellow. This individual, he's been a consultant, and he's briefed ambassadors to Yemen, he's briefed the CIA, he's briefed various other, he's briefed American politicians on the situation on the ground in Yemen. He's lived in Yemen for years, he speaks the language, he speaks multiple languages in the region. You know, he was a phenomenal expert on Yemen. And he said that from 2001, essentially, until 2008, Al-Qaeda did not have any measure of strength in Yemen. So for the government to allege that Tariq went there in order to link up with Al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. you know, it's absurd.
And did the prosecution cross-examine any of your witnesses?
Certainly, they didn't have much luck at it.
I wouldn't imagine they would with the kind of experts you guys brought.
Let me ask you something, Pete. Now, if we're saying that Tariq went there in order to seek military training so that he could continue on to Iraq to fight, mm-hmm. Now here's my question for you. I told you earlier that Abu-Zahra came back before getting to Yemen. Now the other individual that went with my brother, he continued on to Iraq. He actually made his way to Fallujah. Mm-hmm. So you tell me, if my brother went there in order to seek military training, why didn't he just continue along with this individual to Iraq? Why did my brother come back after 2 weeks to the United States?
Well, even besides that, I think it's ridiculous, even if your brother did go to Iraq or any of these other countries. I have friends who've traveled to other countries. Why is that a crime? Where's the evidence that any military training was taking place, even if he went to a place that had a military training within the country, where's the evidence that he attended that particular military training?
Well, again, you know, we have this socio-political climate here in the United States that equates, you know, like any like Islam-derived endorsement of force, even when it's an endorsement for the use of force in a defensive capacity. You know, my brother advocated that Iraqis have the right to defend themselves against, you know, invading U.S. forces.
Mm-hmm.
My brother didn't advocate for Americans to go over there and fight. No, he simply said, look, you know, the Iraqi people, they live in Iraq, and, you know, the United States is a foreign invader.
Mm-hmm.
That Iraqi people have the right to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the government did everything that it could to twist us into condoning anything from extremist violence to the beheading of American contractors. Like, really? My brother never even... half of these videos of, like, beheadings and things like this were never even on my brother's computer.
Mm-hmm.
And the judge allowed this. But, I mean, it doesn't matter that Tariq didn't continue on to Iraq. Apparently it doesn't matter. It's okay. You know, we still know that he went there to seek, you know, military training. Really?
Well, I don't understand how, you know, your brother's intent only exists in the mind of the prosecution.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, when the judge allows them to play fast and loose with evidence like that,
mm-hmm.
when he allows them to present any type of inflammatory evidence, no matter how little it has to do with my brother, then, you know, after hours and hours and hours of this day after day after day, jury, I mean, they stopped differentiating between, oh, this was, you know, found on his computer, and this is just something that the prosecution's using to paint a backdrop for their case.
Right.
They just attributed it all to my brother.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that my brother had writings, many writings, where he explicitly condemned, you know, the use of force against innocent people, where he condemned the notion that we should not have loyalty to the laws of the United States, you know, where he confronted and refuted pretty much every one of, you know, Al-Qaeda's beliefs. I mean, the defense went, they made a checklist. They literally made a checklist of Al-Qaeda's beliefs, and then they just checked off the ones that Tariq, you know, took a strong stance against. And by the end of doing that, everything was checked off except for the right of Muslims to defend themselves when their country is invaded.
Now, I don't know if you could confirm this for me or not, but a while back I had heard that even the term Al-Qaeda was invented by the CIA, and it was a loose association of all these different groups that the CIA was involved with. This was not an organized group of people within the Middle East.
Right. These, Al-Qaeda actually originated in Afghanistan at the tail end of the Afghan-Soviet War. Because, you know, this was during the late 1980s when the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan and committing horrible war crimes against the Afghani people who lacked, you know, any weapons that could enable them to stand up to the Soviet,
mm-hmm.
to the Soviets. And so the CIA undertook, essentially, if you've ever seen Charlie Wilson's War, I mean, that's basically, it lays it all out right there. This was the CIA's most expansive covert operation ever. And our expert Mark Sageman, he was the one who was in charge of getting the weapons and intelligence to the Afghanis. He was a CIA, as he put it, he was a spy master. And he was the one who had total oversight over that entire project. I mean, these are the kinds of witnesses that we're bringing here to to provide context and insight to the jury, and evidently it wasn't enough. It's not enough to bring the world's leading expert on counterterrorism, to say that this individual is not a terrorist. The jury still convicted him on all counts. It's crazy.
Those were seven felony counts?
Seven felony counts, and facing as much as life in prison.
Mm-hmm.
For translating materials, for taking a trip to Yemen, despite the fact that there's no proof that anything, you know, that there were any malintentions associated with it. You know, it's really a sad day for the First Amendment right there. It's really a sad day that a jury of American citizens would find one of their fellow citizens guilty of terrorism simply because he was sharing his views.
Mm-hmm.
It's really sad. Shocking.
How long did the jury deliberate?
After 34 days of testimony in an extremely complicated case, they deliberated, I think one newspaper pegged it at 10 hours.
Wow.
10 hours of deliberation. You know, so it's many legal experts were expecting it to take quite a bit longer than that. They were expecting at least a couple of more days of deliberation because, I mean, there was many issues at play here. There's many issues at play. They were not easy to understand, particularly coming from, you know, a perspective lacking context into Islam, into religious scripture, into U.S. law and what it says about conspiracy. You see, one of the charges, or three of the charges, excuse me, were based on this concept of conspiracy. And conspiracy is just this vacuous term which essentially comes down to, two or more individuals agree to do something.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and what the prosecution was burdened with doing is to prove that my brother and the individuals that he went to Yemen with were engaged in a conspiracy that would lead to them being in a position to kill American soldiers, to kill civilians in shopping malls here, and that this spreading of translated material was in service to and in coordination with Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because the conspiracy to provide material support, the criteria for that, according to a Supreme Court ruling in the Humanitarian Law Project, which was kind of a landmark case as relates to, you know, the material support clause, what the Supreme Court ruled was that in order for speech like what my brother was being, you know, prosecuted for to constitute material support to terrorism, it has to, his advocacy of views that are consistent with those of a designated terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
his advocacy of the same views must be conducted in coordination with, quote-unquote, or at the direction of this group. You see, to give you an analogy,
still there? Well, lost again. Well, hang on a moment. Well, I get Tamer back. Not a problem. Welcome back.
Thank you. Are we live?
Yes.
So I was just providing the analogy that, you know, of how the of what needs to be in place in order to satisfy the requirements of the material support clause.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, again, if I'm a patient who's on a certain medication and I recommend it to a friend of mine,
mm-hmm.
you know, this being analogous to spreading propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Now, me recommending it to a friend and whether that friend, you know, begins taking it or not,
mm-hmm.
that's not gonna make me be an employee of the company that manufactures it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we call independent advocacy. And the law, U.S. law, protects that. Now, again, you know, analogously, if I was an employee of the company and I'm promoting the product, then this would be, quote-unquote, in coordination with or at the direction of this organization. You see how that works?
Mm-hmm.
So the prosecution had the burden of proving that my brother translating texts was, you know, at the direction of Al-Qaeda.
Right.
Or in coordination with them. And they never proved that. They never provided any evidence at all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the jury still, you know, came back and convicted him of this stuff. And I spoke to his attorneys after the trial yesterday in the parking lot of the courthouse. And I asked them, you know, like, where did things, you know, like, where was the road bump here? How did we get seven guilty verdicts? And they said that it was because Judge O'Toole had delivered the worst instructions to the jury that they had ever seen in their careers as lawyers. He not only gave extremely open-ended instructions for how to interpret the laws about conspiracy,
mm-hmm.
open-ended instructions that essentially any type of agreement, no matter how minor, could satisfy this. Not only that, but he refused to instruct the jury on the First Amendment. Just refused altogether. You know, the defense's entire strategy was built on the First Amendment, and the judge just deemed that it was irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the first time he's done this. He just arbitrarily decides that things are irrelevant when any person with a mind sitting in the audience in the courtroom, you know, wouldn't be able to fathom saying that with a straight face.
So I didn't realize, thinking about this earlier, in the trial that I was involved with, it was a bench trial, so the judge was taking the place of the jury. But in this case, the jury doesn't know what the laws are. They have to be instructed as to what the laws are that they're ruling on.
And absolutely, and that's a very important point, because the laws are complex, the case is complex. You know, they had a difficult task ahead of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Tariq's attorney, Jay Carney, recognized that and requested that the jurors be provided with the instructions in a written format, because he recognized it was going to be very challenging for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the day before the instructions were given, a hearing was held. This was last Thursday,
mm-hmm.
where the defense and prosecution were allowed to make arguments for what instructions should be included.
Mm.
And the judge rejected every single request and recommendation that the defense made, including the most damaging rejections he made was declining to instruct the jury on the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's important for people to remember that the First Amendment was intended to protect unpopular speech, not popular speech. Popular speech doesn't need to be protected. It's mm-hmm. unpopular speech that places individuals at risk in this way.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so we're trying to appeal it right now. I'd like to know, like, what you're more curious about, because I've just kind of been going on and on here, so...
I was really just curious about the details of the story, and after going to the Free Tarek website, which is freetarek.com, for you listeners out there, it's T-A-R-E-K, freetarek.com. I went to the case there and read about it, and I basically, you know, got the main understanding of what was happening. It's very well written, and I read an interview with Tarek that he had written, and the website's very well done, but to hear you flesh out all the details of this, it's been very interesting to hear all the nuances of how this has happened.
I'm very happy to share that information, because it's important not only to my brother and my family, not even just the Muslims here in America, but even to non-Muslim Americans to become aware of how the First Amendment can be so lightly disregarded in a case where it's clearly so central. I mean, if it can happen with my brother's just another American. If it can happen with him, it can happen with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I would just add that the main website that we'd encourage anybody interested in learning more about this case to visit is actually freetarek.wordpress.com.
Okay.
But if you go to freetarek.com, there should be a huge link that can forward you right over to the WordPress site. But we created that site at the beginning of the trial, and it provides, it's essentially like a journal of what took place in the courtroom every single day.
Mm-hmm.
with supporting leaks to mainstream media articles and video coverage. But we encourage anybody to visit that. And it actually also lays out the history of the case in a very concise and easy to follow manner in a chronological way, and provides some insight and context about Tarek's views. But
do you know the history of Judge O'Toole's rulings being overturned? If there's a lot of appeals on the cases he rules on?
I'm not entirely certain what the history of his cases are, but from what I've heard from legal experts, including both attorneys and academics from the Boston area, I think one of them, I think it was Professor George Brown from Boston College, described this case as having, quote-unquote, Supreme Court written all over it.
Mm.
So it seems likely that this is going to need to be taken a step beyond the appellate court,
mm-hmm,
and taken to the Supreme Court.
So do you have to go through the appellate court first?
I think so, and Tarek's attorneys have already expressed their commitment to being through the appeal process, and they've already begun to prepare the necessary submissions in order to get that rolling.
Excellent. And then how long do you think, is there any expectations of how long it will take for the appeal process to take place?
I've heard it can take as long as 2 years, as long as 2 to 3 years even.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping it doesn't take that long, but, you know, I mean, we being, you know, my brother, my family, and I, and all of the individuals who've been supporting our campaign, the Free Tarek campaign, we're patient and we're committed, and, you know, we're eager to share the truth of what's going on with my brother's case in the meantime with you know, the local public, and to get the word out about, like, what's really going on here, because it's really... It was shocking to everybody in that courtroom,
mm-hmm,
that Tarek Mahano was found guilty on all these charges. It was completely shocking.
Mm-hmm. Is your brother in the same prison that he's been in? Did they return him back to the same place, or is
he's over at Plymouth County Correctional Facility, back in isolated confinement as we wait for the appeal process to move forward, and also we wait for sentencing. Sentencing mm-hmm. will be on April 12th.
Is there any way that people can support him with letters, or is he not able to get them?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. We have actually on the Free Tariq website, we have his address under a link that says, you know, like, write to Tariq. And, yeah, we encourage anybody, and you know what, even, like, whether you support him or not, like, if you're curious, if you don't know what to think and you're curious, feel free to write to him and engage him directly and see what he has to say.
Uh-huh.
And at this point, we're just, we're really just hoping that the justice system will function better at the appellate level than it has at the level that we saw yesterday, because it was just shocking. I'm sorry. It was a great shock to all of us.
Well, I certainly hope that things go better at the appellate level, not only for your brother's sake, which I do share concern, but for the sake of everyone's protection under the First Amendment.
Absolutely. Again, this isn't just about one individual. This isn't even about one ethnic group. I mean, we're talking about the interpretation of the law. We're talking about what are the limits to which the First Amendment can be suspended, particularly when it comes to issues of national security. I mean, like, are we as citizens just going to give the government, like, carte blanche to decide when to deprive us of civil liberties and when not to? I mean, these civil liberties were put in place in order to, specifically for these types of situations where people's rights are most threatened, where people's livelihood is most threatened. So it's really astonishing to think that it's precisely these situations where the government feels that the First Amendment need not be applied.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very sorry.
We have a long road ahead of us.
Yeah, I'm very sorry to hear the news. So the verdict was given out this past Monday?
It was actually given out yesterday.
Okay.
And, you know, while it was shocking, Pete, again, my family, my brother, and I, and our supporters are very motivated, more motivated than ever to continue supporting his innocence and to really advocate on this broader issue of the First Amendment and the need for people to be aware of how their civil liberties, Muslim or non-Muslim, are being threatened, and we're going to continue doing that, and we encourage anybody who is curious, please visit the website, please visit the blog, learn about this case. It's one example of many where civil liberties are being curtailed, and please feel free to reach out to us with questions or comments about, you know, about your thoughts and concerns about this issue. But no, really, we appreciate a great deal you inviting us onto the show. And
you're welcome.
And again, any questions? You know, we're very open to sharing information about Tariq's experience and about our experience with us.
Okay. Well, if as things develop, if anything develops either with the appeal or with the sentencing as April approaches, let me know, and I'd love to have you guys on the show again.
Absolutely, absolutely. And again, we go to great lengths to make sure that the blog is updated with the most up-to-date information possible, but we will absolutely remain in touch with you. And again, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.
And we hope that we're able to expand your listeners' understanding of what's been going on here in Boston.
I appreciate your time, and take care.
Thank you so much, Pete. Take care.